Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with Nancy Pelosi's warning that centrist candidates are the way to beat Trump in 2020. This underscores the mainstream Democratic establishment strategy that centrist candidates are needed to win over their independent or center-right Republican neighbors. Whether or not this strategy works, electability is, almost by definition, something that should be determined by voters. Moreover, male pundits focus on the electability of female candidates far more often than their male counterparts, and often over superficial matters like clothing style and physical appearance. Female candidates face backlash over demonstrating stern or aggressive behaviors, whereas male candidates are praised for demonstrating such behavior. Joining us is Amanda Marcotte, a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She is the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters, set on rat-effing liberals, America, and the truth itself. And she has an article at Salon, Are Centrist Candidates Really the Most Electable? It may be the opposite. In arguing that Democrats should not have to choose between progressive politics and winning elections, she posits that we shouldn't be cautious with elections, but that we need radical change and voting for a more progressive candidate is a risk we should be willing to take. Moreover, she argues that America is ready for a female president, but as long as vocal male pundits in the mainstream media are not, they are thereby lessening the chances of a woman becoming president. Then we will speak with Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, who is a former Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. He joins us to discuss his new book just out, Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy, and how Putin and his cronies have systematically looted the cash cow Gazprom, whose fortunes have sunk from $369 billion in 2008 to barely $60 billion today. And with $800 billion in Russian private wealth held abroad, it is estimated that Putin's share of that is as much as $160 billion. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Amanda Marcotte, a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and the Truth Itself. And she has an article at Salon, Are Centrist Candidates Really the Most Electable? It May Be the Opposite. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Marcotte.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you've raised the big issue now in this crowded field of Democrats running for president. And to my mind, there's an awful lot at stake. And I'm not sure we need to be reminded of that. But there's still a lot of anger about what happened with Trump winning and Hillary Clinton losing. And to some extent, people have blamed her. But there's obviously some sort of residual anger amongst rank-and-file Democrats that how could we be beaten by this horrible man? And now you have a situation where we simply can't be beaten by him in 2020 because we know what's at stake. But if we are beaten by him in 2020, to my mind, that might well be the end of the Democratic Party.
Or our democracy itself, in fact.
Right. Well, and that's true. So given that awesome responsibility, where do we stand? You're making the case that we need to be inspired and not cautious.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of people making the argument that, like it or not, we need to run someone like Joe Biden, you know, a white guy, more moderate or centrist, that just feels like a safe choice and not, you know, risky. And I say that the idea that it's somehow safer to run kind of a milquetoast white guy candidate that doesn't really inspire people is much more dangerous than rolling the dice and going with somebody who is able to turn out big crowds, who might have an identity that isn't white or male, you know, that kind of sticks out a little. And, you know, I think that you can kind of see how this played out in 2004 and 2008, right? In 2004, the Democrats decided to play it safe. They ran John Kerry, and nothing against him, but he's not exactly inspiring a lot of people's passions. He's kind of a bland white guy. And in 2008, you know, the Democrats ran the risky candidate, Barack Obama, the one that everyone said wasn't electable because he had a funny name and he's black and he's from Chicago and he's not a veteran and all these things. And he won. He was a smashing success. And I would say that that is not a coincidence. I think that, in fact, you know, one of the advantages Obama had going into the 2008 election is he didn't seem like the typical candidate. He wasn't safe, but he wasn't boring either.
Well, there were some outside factors, one of which was the economy was collapsing. Wall Street had almost took down the global economy. And that's, of course, one of the great ironies about Trump. He's benefiting from the economy that Obama brought back. And that sort of maxim, you know, it's the economy, stupid, from Carville, seems to be what's operating now, right? How do you explain the fact that Trump is going up in the polls?
I mean, I do think it's the economy. I think that a lot of people, I think the number one rule of understanding American politics is the vast majority of voters do not pay attention to politics. Americans have no idea that their democracy is threatened. They have no idea that Donald Trump is nearly as bad as he is because they don't read the news, they don't watch cable news, they don't really follow politics. They know that he's a jerk, but they don't know that he's trying to dismantle democracy in order to save himself and make money. And unfortunately, I feel that no matter how many exposés the Washington Post runs of Donald Trump, it's not penetrating because that requires people reading and paying attention, and they just don't do that. And I think that that kind of underlines my point, though, about why you kind of need a little razzle-dazzle to win the voters over. I mean, Donald Trump, just like Barack Obama, had that. Like, he was a TV star. He's a loudmouth. Say what you will about the man, he gets people's attention, and that was enough to bring him to victory. And I think, you know, the Democrats need to be able, you know, no risk, no reward, I think, needs to be the way of thinking instead of, you know, trying to play it safe and discourage people from voting because they can't even be bothered to pay attention to who your candidate is.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and the Truth Itself. And she has an article at Salon, Are Centrist Candidates Really the Most Electable? It may be the opposite. So while I entirely agree with your article, Amanda, I also have to pinch myself and recognize that if anybody shared my political beliefs, they would be completely unelectable in America. And you put it down to the fact that they don't pay attention to politics. But in general, the impression is that it's a pretty conservative electorate out there and that we are unlike the Europeans who have social democracy, where they vote for people who deliver government services. We vote for people for all kinds of extraneous reasons about guns and abortion, etc. So I guess when you talk about emotions, I guess it's more about emotions, right? More about the heart than the head. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, and I think that that's probably true in a lot of places. I think that it is true that people don't really necessarily vote policy most or any of the time. They vote their identity. They vote these culture war issues. You see this kind of, like, especially on the right, you see the situation where men get mad about, say, the Me Too movement and somehow conclude that means they need to vote for lower taxes for the rich, right? And I think that is both a problem and an opportunity for the Democrats, right? it says that they don't need to feel cobbled by this like attempt to appeal to people with conservative policies, because the voters aren't paying attention to policies anyway. So what they need to do is, again, seem like you're standing for something, seem bold, be attention getting. I think that this fear of being perceived as a socialist is really out of line. For one thing, Donald Trump and the Republicans are going to call the Democrat a socialist, whether it's Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, right? So there's no escaping that label. And I think that it's very rare for a voter to actually do the work of like looking at the policies you're supporting and seeing if they agree with them or not. What I do think gets voters out is a sense that the candidate is somebody bold with good ideas who's willing to fight for them. And in a sense, running on strong left-leaning progressive policies sends that message, because it sort of captures that sense of boldness that people are looking for more than the policies themselves.
So how then do you explain these early polls that has Biden going up and up and up? He's now at 40%, and the others are trailing by even greater numbers than they were.
Oh, Biden's getting like three or four times as much coverage in the media. That's strictly name recognition. Voters don't know who the other candidates are. They turn on the 5 minutes of news they absorb a day is Joe Biden, Joe Biden, Joe Biden. So when a pollster calls them and asks them who they're voting for, they're like, I guess Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. He's the one, right? I don't think it's anything more than that.
Well, but trying to be the devil's advocate here, if Hillary Clinton lost so narrowly 77,000 votes in those three key states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, one of the postmortems was that people that showed up to vote for Obama didn't show up for her. Mm-hmm. And the assumption or the conclusion would be that she somehow didn't inspire, particularly in Milwaukee, the African-Americans, et cetera. They've done all kinds of slicing and dicing on that. So that's one school of thought. But then the other interpretation of what happened with the recent Democratic victory in taking back the House was that the people who took back the House, a lot of them, although with the exception out here in California, most of them were very centrist and were running in purple districts and were hewing to the center in order to win over disaffected Republicans. So how do you reconcile those two schools of thought?
I think the people that thought you had to run to the center in 2018 to win those districts are flat out wrong. The political science showed that those districts are going to be won by a Democrat, whether they were left, right, center, doing a tap dance on the ceiling. It had very little to do with the candidates themselves and the policies that they had, and more that the midterm election was a repudiation of Trump and everything he stands for. Democrats turned out the vote. Republicans did not. There is some evidence that there was a decline in Republican voter turnout, that they are demobilized, perhaps a little ashamed of Donald Trump. Those things matter way more than the slate of policies you publish on your website.
Well, but I mentioned earlier, Trump is going up in the polls, and the interpretation is that the way that Barr has blunted the impact of the Mueller report and that the Republicans have muddied the water so that nobody really knows what's in the Mueller report. I think we'd be in a very different world had Mueller been able to get the report out without it being intercepted and spun by Barr. Had he done so, I think we'd be in an extremely different position today, and there may well be a clamor for impeachment as opposed to a sense as it's all over, as Lindsey Graham is now trying to say. And I think that's the explanation, isn't it, for why Trump's going up in the polls. People actually support the idea that it was a witch hunt and it's over.
No, I think it's more complicated than that. I mean, I think you're right that the propaganda was effective. But I would point out that Trump being up in the polls means that his highest ceiling, he still never reaches like 50%. His ceiling is like 46%, basically, approval ratings. So on his best day, he's usually doing worse than Obama was doing in all but a handful of his worst parts of his in like 8-year run in terms of approval ratings. Trump is not popular. The majority of Americans think he's lying about Russia. They think that they surprisingly, despite all the spin, they surprisingly grasp that the majority of Americans surprisingly grasp that the Mueller report does not exonerate Trump. That, and I think it's because he's so obviously like a grifter and you know, a criminal or criminal adjacent, at least, that there's no way that you're convincing people that this is an innocent man. He's obviously a con artist. And I think you don't need to watch the news very closely to know that about Donald Trump. So yeah, he goes up and down from that like 35 to 45% approval rating, but those are all basically Republicans. To win the election, I think he's going to have to like somehow get higher than that. And I don't see any evidence that's happening.
Well, this recent letter from 450 former federal prosecutors makes the case that they think that Donald Trump is a criminal.
Yeah, I mean, I think Donald Trump is a criminal. I think that it's irrefutable if you actually look at the evidence. I think that the question here is that he is out of the grasp of prosecution, criminal prosecution, because of his role as the president, and impeachment is the only solution, legal solution that's available right now. And so he gets to live in this sort of ambiguous zone where it's a little bit like being like Julian Assange, like hiding in the Ecuadorian embassy and saying, I'm not a criminal because you haven't caught me yet. And, you know, I do think, though, that people should be very worried about this, because Donald Trump, being the man that he is going to conclude, therefore, that the only solution to his problems is to stay in the office no matter what, because the second he leaves the presidency, he can be arrested and tried for multiple crimes, and he knows that.
Sure. Well, it's exactly what happened with Netanyahu in the recent election in Israel. And do you think that's what prompted Nancy Pelosi saying that she thought that Trump wouldn't want to leave office if he lost in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, she has a read of the man, say what you will, and I think that she's right. I think there's a lot of things about Donald Trump that are distressing and chaotic, but he is actually a pretty predictable character in that if he's, you can always kind of figure out what he's going to do because by saying to yourself, if I had no moral compass and no respect for the rules, and the only person I ever cared about in the world was myself, what choice would I make in this situation? And whatever the answer is what he's going to do. And so he doesn't care about our democracy. He doesn't care about rule of law. He doesn't care about morality. He wants to save his own skin. So if he concludes that the way to do that is to refuse to relinquish the office, that's exactly what he'll do.
And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Amanda Marcotte. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She is the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America and the Truth Itself. And she has an article at Salon, Are Centrist Candidates Really the Most Electable? It may be the opposite. So back to your article, Amanda Marcotte, at Ceylon, are centrist candidates really the most electable? It may be the opposite. You do a breakdown here, which I think the data came from Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Economically conservatives but socially liberal voters only constitute about 4% of the electorate, in contrast to consistently liberals voters who are 45% of the electorate, and economically liberal but socially conservatives are 29% of the electorate, and consistently conservatives are 23%. So if you do the math, well, I guess on the surface, the conservatives would have more, right? If you combine 29 and 23 as opposed to 45 and then 4, that's the sort of fable.
Socially liberal, yeah.
Yeah, right.
But if you look at it from an economic perspective, the liberals are much, much bigger category, because you have these economically, or the socially conservative but economically liberal group, plus the 45% of Americans that are just straight up liberals. I mean, that's an overwhelming number of Americans that support economically liberal policies.
Well, the way that I've seen the American electorate for as long as I've been here, which is a while, it seems to me that the Republicans are very good at getting every one of their voters out, and they're very good at suppressing the votes on the other side, or discouraging them, or in fact flat out suppressing them. On the other side, you've got a natural majority of who would vote Democrat, but they don't get inspired and they don't show up. So that kind of, if my theory is correct, then that totally supports what you're saying.
Yeah, no, I think we're in complete agreement here. I think that what you have is 45% of Americans that, if they voted every single time, would be large enough numbers to win every election, at least the presidential elections, and could regain quite a bit of the House and hold it for a long time. I mean, there's other problems that the Republicans have tilted the playing field to themselves unfairly in a lot of ways that are very difficult structurally to get over. But once you have 45% of the vote or of people agreeing with you sort of built in, it's very easy to like kind of get up to that 51% that you need, especially considering that Democratic economic policies are a lot more popular than Republican economic policies across the board. I think, however, one thing that makes it difficult to get some of those swing voters when the economy is good is that people don't feel like socially conservative, economically liberal voters, which are called populists for the sake of this category. They don't vote for Democrats when times are good. They feel safe. They feel complacent. They feel secure. So they're more willing to vote their cultural resentments. You know, they're more willing to vote because they're racist or misogynist or homophobic or whatever. And it's only in situations, like you said, in the 2008 election where the economy was crashing, that a certain percentage of those voters were like, they don't like the Democrats, but they also recognize they're better for them economically. So they were willing to stifle their racism and vote for Barack Obama.
Well, I would describe the Democrats, their political advisors are serial losers. I mean, the Republican political advisors like Karl Rove, they got a pretty good track record. The guys that you see on TV, you know, the Bob Schrums of this world, they've all made a career out of losing. And there has been a string of candidates. You mentioned Kerry. Kerry was a war hero, but he wimped out when Karl Rove brought up that phony swift boat attack on him, you know. Mm-hmm. Then you go back a bit. You got Dukakis, clearly a total wuss. And then Mondale, who came across as a wuss as well. The ones that get elected, like Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, Clinton, I guess Carter to a lesser extent, and Obama. I don't know how you could describe them. They're not wusses. They're certainly more like macho liberals. So if that's the case, how do you apply that to the women that are running? Because there's a total double standard. The women are being described as being not likable, etc., whereas the men don't get labeled in that way. They get a free pass. Is there a macho woman out there that could be tough in the way that the tougher guys, at least compared to the wimpy ones, are the ones that got elected in the recent history of the Democratic Party?
So I don't like the word macho.
I bet you don't.
But I think that, it implies that this kind of boldness is something that is exclusive to men. And I don't think that you think that or I think that. I think that a lot of female politicians are perceived as, especially if they get to present themselves to the voters without being mediated through a sexist media, right? That describes them as unlikable or shrill or all these other sexist stereotypes. I think that there are a lot of female politicians that the voters feel are fighters, feel are strong personalities, feel are inspiring people that they look up to. I mean, I think people love Elizabeth Warren. People love Kamala Harris. They don't feel lukewarm about those women at all, especially when they go to their rallies and they actually get to look at them be in the world and not have it all filtered through these male pundits who are uneasy with female ambition and therefore stereotype and degrade these women. I think Hillary Clinton is a little less of that, but she certainly was popular. And I think it's worth remembering she got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump in the election. She was just kind of hurt by an electoral college system that is deeply undemocratic. So I think that a woman who doesn't have as much political baggage as Hillary Clinton had going into 2016 has a better chance. I think Hillary Clinton has always been a little bit wary. She's always been a little less good at kind of putting herself out there. It's clear that it's a little bit more of a struggle for her to be a speechifying politician than some of these other women. I think somebody who's better at that, like Warren or Harris, would do better. And I think, frankly, that watching Hillary Clinton run, watching her lose, even though she should have won, probably did a number on a lot of people that they never really completely thought about how the possibility of having a female president, of the sexism that they're up against. I think it's just going to be a very different world in 2020. You're going to see a lot more people used to the idea of a female president because we almost had one. You're going to see better candidates that have a little bit more personality on their trail. And I think you're going to see a lot of women that are real, real angry at watching Hillary Clinton lose for dumb reasons that are going to be out there and willing to fight. So I think we're just in a very different situation than we were in 2020 or 2016, I mean.
Right. But the caveat that you brought up is a very valid one, and that is the Electoral College. By the year 2050, there'll be 70 Republican senators to 30 Democratic senators based upon the fact that people are leaving the red states, moving to the blue states, and when they do so, their vote gets diluted, as what happened with Hillary Clinton. And Trump's path to re-election will probably mean he'll have an even greater deficit in the popular vote, but he doesn't give a damn, obviously. And on top of that, the Democrats have to get 8% more votes than Republicans just to break even.
Yeah, and I think that that's a problem for Democrats, not for women, per se.
Sure, exactly. Right.
I think...
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I hope. It's about time we had a woman president, and you feel that the electorate's ready for it.
Yeah, I think the electorate's ready for it. I don't know if the male-dominated punditry is ready for it. But I will say that we lost some of the worst pundits from 2016 to the Me Too movement. Matt Lauer, some of the other men that were the very worst pundits in 2016 have been outed as sexual harassers and are gone now. So maybe we'll have a different discussion on cable news in 2020.
Well, Amanda Marcotte, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Marcotte, who's a feminist author, blogger, and a politics writer for Salon. She's the author of Troll Nation, How the Right Became Trump-Worshipping Monsters Set on Rat-Effing Liberals, America, and the Truth Itself. And she has an article at Salon, Are Centrist Candidates Really the Most Electable? It May Be the Opposite. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Putin's kleptocracy and how he and his cronies have systematically looted the cash cow Gazprom, whose fortunes have sunk from $369 billion in 2008 to barely $60 billion today. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Putin's kleptocracy and how he and his cronies have systematically looted the cash cow Gazprom, whose fortunes have sunk from $369 billion in 2008 to barely $60 billion today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anders Asland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. His books include Europe's Growth Challenge, Ukraine, What Went Wrong, and How to Fix It. And his latest book just out is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Asland.
Thank you very much, Ian.
So, Anders, there was a phone call a week ago between Putin and Trump that went for over an hour. We don't know what was actually said. There's no readouts of his conversations and all of his private prior conversations in person at the various venues like the G8 and the G20, et cetera. There was no note takers. So we don't know what goes on in these conversations between Putin and Trump. But so what's your sense of why it is that the Republican Party, which was normally the, if you go back in history to the McCarthy days, they were the red baiters and the Soviet haters, they all seem to be in a curious kind of collusion of not feeling that there's anything wrong with the fact that we have a president who, according to the Mueller report, he may consider himself exonerated, but there's an awful lot of evidence in Volume 1 of cooperation and coordination, possible conspiracy with the Russians. And so we have no idea whether, in fact, the conspiracy is continuing to this day. So what's your sense of there in Washington is why we can't get some clarity on this relationship our president has, so that we know what goes on in these private conversations?
Well, I think that the short answer is that the Republican Party accepts whatever President Trump says, and therefore there's not sufficient pressure up on him. I was quite astounded. And as it is, the first substantial information I got about the talk came not from President Trump, but from President Vladimir Putin. There were two big points. One was that we had discussed Ukraine after the presidential elections, with Volodymyr Zelensky becoming president. There, substantially, which Trump did not mention in his first conversation with journalists. And the second point was that we had discussed bilateral relations substantially, while it seemed much less from Trump's statement, and that we had discussed economic bilateral relations, which must mean an attempt to reduce the sanctions. And then the third thing that we can see now afterwards is that And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has suddenly cancelled his trip to Germany, which was quite important. And instead, he's going to Sochi to see Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov of Russia, which clearly suggests that bilateral top-level meeting between Putin and Trump is underway, about which neither of them talked. So to me, this is obvious collusion going on. And from the Mueller report, we know that Trump worked hard to get a Trump Tower in Moscow that could have given him hundreds of millions of dollars. And how this cannot be considered corruption of the president is beyond my understanding of law.
So I read a recent poll here from Russia done by Gallup that found that 44% of Russians aged 15 to 29 want to emigrate as their economy stagnates. And most of them apparently wanted to go to either Germany or the United States. That is an absolutely terrible indictment of a country when it's young, the future, see no future in their own country.
Yeah, and I think it's not so much that the economy is not developing. Russia's had a growth rate of only 1% on average for the last decade, but that people feel that there's no demand for them, that all the top jobs are taken by the kids of Putin's friends. So there's no normal space, and you're not supposed to set up an independent enterprise any longer, but work for the state.
So I can't see a future here in terms of an economic projection. And your new book really does go through the sort of chapters, if you will, of Putin's rule, since he's ruled for so long and he keeps sort of coming back. Even while, of course, Medvedev was nominally the president, he was the prime minister and really running the show from behind the scenes. And I think that was a big mistake on the part of the Obama administration. They kept talking to Medvedev as though he were the president. And I believe that Putin thought, what idiots they are. What was your take on that? Because this is clearly somebody who is often called the new czar, and he has no way out, does he? I mean, he's going to be in there until he drops dead or somebody puts a bullet in his head.
Yeah, so I think that the best way of understanding Putin's regime, it is that it is a personal authoritarian regime. And such regimes depend on one person. It's not, there's no ideology, there's no real party there, and there's no monarchy. And there's certainly no value. So it's not an imperialist regime. It's not an expensive regime. It's just a regime that wants to survive. So I think that one should define Putin in two terms: power and wealth. That's what he's interested in. And in order to maintain that, he needs to have a certain amount of circus abroad. That is small victorious wars, that is favorite.
And again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book just out is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. So let's talk about how much money is looted through Putin and his cronies and the oligarchs, and why it is parked abroad. And again, you get back to the question of, you know, is Putin going to get to spend this money? I mean, what are the estimates on his personal wealth? At least $160 billion, right?
Yeah, my estimate is $100 to $160 billion. And I arrive at that by seeing how much Putin and his friends are taking out of the state companies, most of all from the state gas monopoly company, Gazprom. And we know that from 2004 when Putin really got his machine going. They have taken out $10 to $15 billion a year from Gazprom and say that the total is about twice as much because we are tapping a lot of other state companies and in particular the banks on money as well. So that gives us $15 to $25 billion a year. And this money is then largely taken out of Russia. And the curious reason is that money is not safe in Russia. There are no property rights because the ruler in Russia controls property rights, which means that they are only there for the ruler as long as he's a ruler. So therefore, Putin needs to take out his own money in order to keep it safe in countries that have rule of law and anonymous ownership and deep financial markets.
So does that mean that Putin is looking over his shoulder, thinking that there'll be some kind of coup against him at some point?
I think that all long-lasting rulers always look over their shoulders, and I think that Putin is very skillful in this regard. He knows that he's never safe.
Well, just to touch on Gazprom that you do in your new book, Anders Aslan, Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy, the Gazprom, which Putin and his cronies have looted, they had at their peak in May of 2008 $369 billion in reserves, and now they've got barely $60 billion. Yet the CEO, Alexei Miller, who basically should be held responsible for the company losing $310 billion, remains in place. So that sort of tells a story, doesn't it?
Yes, it says that Miller does exactly what Putin wants him to do. He doesn't work for the shareholders or interested in the market value of a company. He works for the contractors. And the contractors are Putin's close friends from St. Petersburg who are tapping the company on money by building all these pipelines that nobody needs. And they are charging twice as high price approximately for these pipelines because there's no competition. And the very idea is to take out money from Gazprom. We're often talking about Russian state television. In fact, 20 of 22 television channels in Russia are owned by Yuri Kovalchuk, one of Putin's close friends, who is then controlling three big media holdings with all these television channels, which means that Putin has personal control through his friends over the television.
But why would they do stupid, wasteful projects? Why not do stuff that would benefit the Russian people and therefore make them more popular?
Well, you don't get much large kickbacks from medicine or from education. And it requires very many people. If you build pipelines, then you don't need very many people. It's a lot of equipment and you can overcharge on the prices. So this is a standard thing. You know, most places in the world where you have corruption, you have it in big construction projects because they are most difficult to assess properly in price.
So walk us through the different Putin regimes and how the economies changed as Putin became more and more of a kleptocrat.
Yeah, Putin has moved deliberately and slowly. He has not allowed himself to be stressed or pushed around. During the first period, he was literally everything to every person. Everybody seemed to like him because he took care of most things. The only people who didn't like him were human rights activists and media people, because there he made sure that he got control. But essentially, he took control over the state during his first term. During his second term, which was inaugurated with the confiscation of Yukos oil company, Putin went for state capitalism. And in his third informal term, when Dmitry Medvedev was formerly president, Putin, on the contrary, went for asset stripping, massive asset stripping from the state companies. And several of these state companies are actually non-governmental organizations formally, and actually owned in practice by Putin himself. And what we have seen since 2012 is what Russians call manual management, which means that Putin does what he wants. And the consequence of this is that growth has gone from 7% a year during his first 9 years to 1% a year on average during the last decade. So this personal management by Putin, it means that growth is very low. And Putin doesn't seem to care about economic growth. What he does care about is macroeconomic stability. Russia has a very small public debt. The budget is, the state budget is usually balanced. And Russia has massive foreign surpluses, which has given large international reserves. And inflation is low, unemployment is low. But Putin wants to make sure that there is stability, but growth and the standard of living. He doesn't care about these two things.
Well, with Russian private wealth abroad assessed at $800 billion, and a lot of that is Putin's, and does he use money not just for personal aggrandizement? Because I don't know that you can have that many yachts and that many mansions. Does he use this money for political ends? For example, in regulating the oligarchs, as he did in that famous meeting after, as you mentioned, in the second term, when he got rid of Khodorkovsky and confiscated Yukos oil. Prior to that, there was that big meeting where all the oligarchs were there, and that seemed to be a sort of important moment when he essentially decided to become the kind of regulator of the oligarchs. And by jailing Khodorkovsky, who had the temerity to talk about democracy, he sent the unmistakable signal to the others that you essentially report in to me. And my understanding is that the Siloviki, the security guys surrounding him, all of his KGB cronies, in effect, like they have a FSB officer sitting outside the door of all of the oligarchs. So are these oligarchs then the conduits through which Putin uses the money that he loots from Russia for political ends, one of which, of course, is the election operation here in the United States, the active measures campaign to help elect Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. Not that there was a lot of money involved in that, but I'm wondering whether, for example, Russian investments in Kentucky help Mitch McConnell. How does the system work?
Well, I think that the most striking thing in the Mueller report, that is how Paul Manafort has been working for a long time, since 2005, on and off for Alexei Deripaska, and received at least $60 million from Deripaska. Deripaska, in turn, has received on a number of occasions big state subsidies. So Deripaska is operating as an agent of the Kremlin in this regard. And several of Deripaska's top executives, three of them, have been revealed to be senior GRU operatives, that is, military intelligence operatives. And then you wonder if Deripaska works through spies and he pays Manafort to work with these spies. In what way is not Manafort also a GRU agent? And I can't understand why Robert Mueller did not draw this very obvious conclusion. But this shows how the money is being used. But we don't see that it's direct money from Putin in the election intervention. The GRU agents who were operating in the U.S., they used bitcoins to pay for their operations in the U.S. But of course, there are many ways in which you can do this, and there are very many sources of money. Another is that we are seeing that a major military contractor, the Internet Research Agent of Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is also organizing these Wagner brigades that have been fighting in Syria, in eastern Ukraine, and now in several countries in Africa, that they are formally private, but obviously Prigozhin is being paid by the military because he's the main caterer to the Russian Defense Ministry, which is completely public.
And again, I'm speaking with Anders Aslan, the author of the brand new book just out, Russia's Crony Capitalism, A Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. So in terms of understanding how Putin is looting the Russian economy and stealing the future from young Russians, and as we mentioned earlier, there is a disturbing Gallup poll that came out recently that 44% of Russians aged 15 to 29 want to emigrate, and most of them want to come to Germany and the United States. So, in effect, they don't see a future, and they see that their future is being stolen. What about the broader issue? Because there was just this, a few days ago, there was this conference in Helsinki about the Arctic, and it was completely surreal in the sense that the Arctic ice is melting because of global warming, yet the United States delegation weren't able to talk about it, and they didn't want it even mentioned in the final communique. Our Secretary of State, Pompeo, talked about how what a great bonanza it is now with the melting ice making it easy to get out oil and minerals. And the reason it's happening is because of global warming, but they don't want to talk about global warming. The effects are happening, you know, sort of magically. But it gets me to what apparently went on with the first Secretary of State, Tillerson, and Putin. As you know, Putin awarded Tillerson with the highest civilian honor in Russia. And a lot of what Tillerson and Exxon were talking about is exploiting the Arctic North as global warming makes oil more accessible. And of course, the point is here is that I don't see that Russia has a future as long as the planet has a future. Because if you burn all of Russia's oil and gas, that would literally be the end of the planet in terms of global warming. And yet they don't have an economy that's in any way diversified, is entirely dependent upon oil and gas. And as you mentioned, as your book makes clear, Gazprom is the cash cow that Putin and his cronies loot. So don't you think we should be discussing Russia in that broader context? I don't want to make Russia responsible for global warming because the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and all these other players are also pushing the global warming denial. But as a country that's entirely dependent on oil and gas, what kind of future does this have? Because the future of the planet is at stake.
Yeah, no, 90% of what Russia exports is oil and gas and metals and other raw materials. And we are not seeing any significant change in it. The only change is that various commodity prices go up and down. The economy has been close to stagnant for the last decade, an average growth of 1%, and nobody really seen any reason for any increase. And there are two problems here. One is kleptocracy, which means that Putin and his people are more interested in taking wealth out of the country, which means low investment. And the other reason is the burden of large military expenditures and also costs of sanctions, which cost Russia 3 to 4% of the GDP each year. So Russia is condemned to near stagnation as long as Putin stays in power. When it comes to global warming, China is much worse. China now accounts for 28% of all greenhouse gases, while Russia actually accounts for less than it used to because many of these very wasteful industries, Soviet industries, have closed down.
And again, I'm speaking with Anders Asland, professor of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and the author of the new book just out, Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. So in terms of this fusion, if you will, between kleptocracy, organized crime, and national security, there's never been a situation in geopolitics, as far as I can remember, where you do have a combination of national security and organized crime, nuclear weapons, and the mafia. And how stable is that situation vis-a-vis Russia? Is Putin really just interested in looting the country? Because a part of his MO, in order to distract the Russian people from how much him and his cronies are stealing, don't they have to do bread and circuses and have little wars in Syria and Ukraine and create little crises in order to keep people distracted?
Indeed. So it appears as if Putin has given up on economic growth, because economic growth would require political and economic reforms that he's not prepared to undertake. Putin is very conscious about the need for macroeconomic stability, low inflation, and that the state finances are in good shape. But you don't eat financial stability. It's just a necessary precondition for everything else. So what we are seeing Putin doing is that he is trying to boost his popularity, which has flagged, because he's not doing much for the population. So Putin is trying to become more popular through what they call in Russian small victorious wars. The ideal was the war in Georgia for 5 days only in August 2008. Didn't cost much, and it showed how strong Russia was. Or the annexation of Crimea from Ukraine in March 2014. That for Russian is the Soviet holiday paradise lost. So this is what we should expect from Putin. The question is, where can he do so? Mainly where NATO doesn't exist. And the gray zone, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova are the obvious places, but also in the Balkans, countries like Bosnia, Macedonia, Montenegro. These are the places that we have seen been subject to various kinds of Russian manipulations. For example, an attempted coup in Montenegro 2 years ago, trying to make sure that Montenegro did not join NATO, which it fortunately did.
Well, Anders Asland, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Anders Asland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book, just out, is Russia's Crony Capitalism, The Path from Market Economy to Kleptocracy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves.